This podcast contains descriptions of violence against children and adult language and is not suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Hi guys, and welcome to Suffer the Little Children, the true crime podcast giving voices back to the victims of child abuse and shining a harsh spotlight on the parents, guardians, and caretakers who silence them. I'm your host, Lane, and this is episode 34, The Ugliest Word. My sources for today's episode are the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, the Center of Expertise on Child Sexual Abuse, the Times Record News, Texoma's homepage, The Sun, Facebook, and the novel The Ugliest Word by Annie Margis. Today's episode is a bit of a departure from my usual format. In each of my previous 33 episodes, I've covered the case of a particular child, doing as deep a dive as possible into each case. Don't worry, going forward, that's still my plan for pretty much every episode. Today, however, because of a unique interview opportunity that came up about this subject, this episode will cover a broad topic that affects far too many children in the United States and all over the world, a topic that author Annie Margis calls the Me Too story that's still taboo. I'm talking about incest, or intrafamilial sexual abuse of children, which in this context is defined as the sexual abuse of a child perpetrated within the family environment. It's a very difficult topic to cover, and it will undoubtedly be triggering for some, but it's also an essential topic of discussion for those of us who truly care about children and want to help those who are vulnerable to any type of child abuse. The World Health Organization, or WHO, calls childhood incest a silent epidemic, but a very important question is, why does it have to be silent? Why are we afraid to talk about a crime that happens every day to countless children? It could be happening in your neighbor's house right now. It could be happening in a family member's house. It could even be happening in your own home without your knowledge. Talking about intrafamilial child sexual abuse can help us recognize the signs of abuse in children and allow us to intervene to help them. And it also helps survivors of incest overcome the shame they feel over something that is in no way their fault. As I was preparing to record this episode, I came across a story about a 34-year-old woman who was arrested just over a week ago in Wichita Falls, Texas, for sexually assaulting her son in 2018 when he was 12 years old. The story is utterly disgusting, and to protect her son's identity, I'm not going to share her name. I am, however, going to tell you what happened because the details really drive home how horrific this crime is. For reasons not specified, the boy, who is now not quite 15, was not in his mother's custody when he recently told his guardian that 2 years ago, he was sitting on the bed he shared with his mother after getting out of the shower when his mother came into the bedroom. As she began undressing, he said, she started asking him questions about masturbation and then told him to strip naked. She then raped her 12-year-old son and afterward told him to go clean himself up. This poor little boy, who chose to sleep on the couch that night rather than sharing a bed with his mother, told her that what happened felt wrong. Her response was,
"Well, you can get in trouble because you accepted it,"
after which she told him,
"Don't tell anyone."
This brave child later repeated his story at Patsy's House Child Advocacy Center, and his disgusting so-called mother was arrested on the morning of Saturday, October 10th, 2020, and charged with aggravated sexual assault. At first, she denied forcing sexual intercourse on her son, but she ultimately confessed. According to reports, she had also admitted to her neighbor that she
slept with her son
2 years ago, although it's not clear if she admitted to the assault or if she meant they literally slept in the same bed. Like most people with functioning brains and moral compasses, I am repulsed by this story and the unimaginable trauma this woman forced on her own child. Of course, because I'm me, I had to do a mini deep dive into this alleged human being's life. It doesn't appear she's ever been charged with any similar crimes, and based on her Facebook page, she has always outwardly appeared to be a doting mother, throwing birthday parties for her son, posting first day of school photos, and supporting his extracurricular activities. In 2011, when she was 25, she married a man 50 years her senior, but they were no longer together at the time of his death in 2017 at the age of 85 because she wasn't mentioned in his obituary. She suffers from diabetes and morbid obesity, which she has apparently battled for years, and it doesn't appear she's dated much since breaking up with her elderly husband. Please don't take this as me making excuses for this pile of human garbage, because there is literally no excuse for what she did. I've just always been fascinated with how the details of a person's life can lead them to commit the crimes I talk about. Anyway, this inhuman waste of breath is being held on a $100,000 bond in Wichita County Jail. Fortunately, her son is now in the care of a loving family with several foster siblings close to his age, and I wholeheartedly hope he will be able to overcome his trauma with time and treatment. This story, unfortunately, is far from unique, and in some cases, sexual abuse can even lead to a child's death. On Suffer the Little Children blog, I've covered several of those cases, such as that of 1-year-old Serenity Sutley, whose story I told in depth in episode 21 of this podcast. Serenity was allegedly raped and killed by her mother's live-in boyfriend, Joshua Gerdo, who, along with Serenity's mother, Kelsey Blankenship, currently awaits trial for Serenity's 2017 murder. In September, I covered the tragic story of 9-month-old Savaya Mason, whose father, Luis Luna, has been charged with raping his infant daughter until she died of asphyxiation with ligature marks on her tiny legs. 2-year-old Stephen Meek II died in January of 2019, and both his mother, Kayla Thomas, and her boyfriend, Mackenzie Hellman, have been charged with his sexual assault and murder, which they allegedly recorded for their sick viewing pleasure. James Beal had just turned 2 when he died on October 31, 2019, after months of alleged abuse by his father's family, although no arrests have ever been made in that case, which you can hear about in my interview with his mother, Kara Witkowski, in episode 26. One last unfortunate example is 18-month-old Kendall Doss, whose mother's live-in boyfriend, Jeremiah Cordell, accepted a plea deal in 2017 that convicted him of the little girl's murder but dismissed multiple other charges against him, including felony deviant sexual intercourse with a child. All of these children, and countless others, were subjected to sexual abuse at the hands of a parent or guardian, someone whose main job is to protect their child from any kind of harm. It boggles the mind that anyone could look at a member of their own family and even consider raping them, let alone a helpless child. According to a 2018 report from the Center of Expertise on Child Sexual Abuse,
around 2/3 of all child sexual abuse, or CSA, reported to the police is perpetrated by a family member or someone close to the child. Where research has recorded the gender of perpetrators of intrafamilial CSA, the vast majority have been found to be male, although abuse by women does occur. In around 1/4 of cases, the perpetrator is under 18. CSA in the family is rarely an isolated occurrence and may go on for many years. Much abuse in the family remains undisclosed. Children may fear their abuser, not want their abuser to get into trouble, feel that the abuse was their fault, and feel responsible for what will happen to their family if they tell. Abuse by a family member may be particularly traumatic because it involves high levels of betrayal, stigma, and secrecy. CSA in the family is linked to a range of negative outcomes over the whole of the life course, including poorer physical and mental health, lower income, relationship difficulties, and further violence and abuse. However, not all survivors experience long-term impacts. Much depends on the nature and duration of the abuse, the individual's coping mechanisms, and the support they receive. Supportive responses from non-abusing carers are particularly important.
It's very hard to get solid statistics about how many children are affected by this scourge because it is an extremely underreported crime. According to the National Child Traumatic Stress Network,
when children are abused by adults who are supposed to protect them from harm, their ability to trust and rely on adults may be shattered. Knowing that the abuser is liked or even loved by other family members makes it all the more difficult for children to tell others about the abuse. Children who have been abused by a family member are more likely to blame themselves for the abuse than those who are abused by someone outside the family unit. This is particularly true of older children who may be all too aware of the effect that disclosing the abuse will have on other family members. As a result, it can take the victims of intrafamilial sexual abuse weeks, months, or even longer to let anyone know that they've been abused, and even longer to reveal all the details. Children from cultures that frown on talking about sex or sexuality may be even more reluctant to tell. Sometimes, in a desperate attempt to make everything better in the family, they may change their story or even deny that the abuse occurred. Recanting or taking back the disclosure is common and does not mean that children were lying about the abuse. When the abuse is caused by a family member, children may feel pressure to recant because of how the disclosure is affecting the family or because of a lack of family support.
The disclosure of this type of abuse can put a massive strain on family relationships, and some family members may refuse to believe the accused abuser could be capable of such horrific acts. Some may feel pressured to take sides. The specter of losing the abuser's income might come into play, causing a family member to dissuade the child from disclosing the abuse to avoid economic hardship, as unthinkable as that might sound. Some might fear losing the support of friends or other family members if the news were to get out. Even trusted religious leaders might give conflicting advice such as,
"Hate the sin, love the sinner,"
while child protective agencies and law enforcement will demand the family cut off all contact with the abuser. All of these factors, and countless others, play into the stigma that surrounds intrafamilial child sexual abuse, or incest, and add to the reasons that so many people are reluctant to talk about it, which is why author Annie Margis has decided to tackle the subject head-on. Annie Margis is an award-winning author, certified ghostwriter, screenwriter, and activist operating out of Long Beach, California. I was recently privileged to speak with Annie about her recently released book, The Ugliest Word, which is a quick read but a gripping story that will stick with you long after you've read the last page. It's the fictional story of a little girl named Lark who is being sexually abused by her father, and Annie tackles this horrifying topic with grace, tact, and a great deal of empathy. The book follows Lark as she comes of age and comes to grips with the years of abuse she has endured and how it has shaped her as a person. Between the blog, the podcast, and two kids doing virtual schooling, I have sadly very little time to read fiction anymore, which is one of my great loves, but I read this book almost entirely in one sitting. Annie's ability to submerge her reader in the scene with descriptive language is exceptional, and Lark and her story stayed with me well after I closed the book. Annie herself is a survivor of childhood incest, and while The Ugliest Word is not a memoir, she was able to infuse Lark with her personal insight to create a truly empathetic and three-dimensional character. The book is also in the process of being adapted into a movie, which we'll discuss a little bit in the interview. Please enjoy my interview with Annie. Today on the podcast, I have with me an author who has written a book called The Ugliest Word. Hi, Annie.
Hi.
Can I ask you to start by telling me how long you've been writing?
Oh, I've been writing since I was a little child, even before I could write. I was making up poetry that rhymed, and I just heard the world that way.
And what other works have you done?
Well, most of my life I was a teacher and I wasn't writing. As a matter of fact, I had a fear of writing. And when the occasions when I did write, I would hide it. I would hide my writing. And so I didn't really do much most of my life. I did do a little humor book after I retired. And I just self-published it. Didn't do anything whatsoever about advertising it. I just published it. And then I wrote a play about incest, which is in fact the start of my novel. The play only dealt with adulthood and how being a victim of incest affects you all the way up until you're old. And then I showed that play to a client of mine who was a movie producer, and he read it and he said, "Oh yeah, let's do this." And he said, "But you have to rewrite it. You have to write it about your childhood." So I wrote a screenplay, and the screenplay was about childhood as well as adulthood. And I gave it to him, and he said, "Oh, no, I couldn't possibly do this. It was too much for him." Luckily, another producer wanted to do it. And so we have that going on. We have the movie going on just in the fundraising stage. But after that, I thought, well, here I have a screenplay and I always wanted to write a book. This is crazy. I need to turn it into a book. And so I did it the wrong way. Usually people write a book and then turn it into a screenplay. But I did it the other way around. And now it's a book. And that's how it got to be a book.
How did you choose your characters' names? I'm just curious about that.
Well, that's an interesting question. I chose Lark because I wanted Lark to be carefree and happy and not affected by child abuse. You know, oh, it's a lark. Oh, it's just a lark. That's all. That's why I chose her name. And Scully's name was kind of a name that my family and I used to say for something that was really bad. Oh, look, it's Scully's golf course, or, you know, it's Scully. It was the name of a character in a movie once. I don't recall the movie, but that was the idea, something bad.
Now, you have mentioned publicly that you are a survivor of childhood incest.
Yes.
How much of the book was actually based on your experiences?
Well, most of the book is not. It is incidents and things that I heard about from other people who are survivors. However, details are of my life. For instance, being raised Catholic, I knew about it, and so I put it in there because that's what I know. The story itself is not my story.
Why do you think it's so important to destigmatize talking about childhood incest?
Because all my life I lived in shame. I was so ashamed. I was so afraid somebody would find out about it. And it's not my shame. I didn't do anything wrong. I was just the victim of a crime. And I think the first time I started to be able to talk about it was when someone else told me that it happened to them too. And I was like, oh, wow, it happened to someone else. Well, of course, I kind of knew that, but It just wasn't logical. I thought I was the only person in the world, you know. But talking about it, if someone had talked about it years before to me, I may have started my healing sooner. And I think it's important. I think of the young people just coming out of it, being able to talk about it and say, hey, this happened to me and it wasn't my fault. And to start healing right away instead of waiting, as so many of us do, until we're postmenopausal and then we start working on it.
Sure. And that's, you know, a lot of years that you wouldn't have to suffer necessarily. As far as the hotline, can you talk about that a little bit, the hotline that you had started?
Yeah, it wasn't a hotline per se. It was a phone conference line where people could call in at the same time. And we would have meetings. It was part of a 12-step anonymous program with formal meetings. And then during the meeting, people would have the opportunity to share for 5 minutes. And no one could interrupt them. They simply shared. No one could respond to them in any way. It was simply a safe 5 minutes to share your story. And so there was the process of sharing was very healing, but so was the process of listening to other people's stories. And one of the things it did for me was desensitize me to the idea that this had happened to me. I began getting used to the idea, okay, yeah, I was a victim, and I began to shed the shame of it.
Is the program still in operation?
Yes, it is.
Oh, great. And what is the name of it, just in case anyone does want to seek it out?
I'm not supposed to say, because it's an anonymous program, and we're not supposed to associate our names with it.
Got it.
However, if you just search on Google, I'm sure you will find, and there's more than one. There are several.
Okay. Yeah. Just researching prior to our conversation, I did find one, and I'll include the link in the show notes just so that that's one resource at least that people will have. I found some other information. It is hard to find information, though, about the topic, just specifically about intrafamilial child sexual abuse. And I think that's probably because, like you said, it's something that not a lot of people want to recognize.
Yes, it's a big taboo, especially incest. That's the biggest taboo of all.
I think it is important to talk about it as part of the Me Too movement as well. But yeah, it does have to be its own conversation.
I think that would help a lot of people. If you could give Lark as a child or any child suffering from this type of abuse any advice, what would it be?
Get out. And that's a really hard thing to say. But as long as you stay, you're going to be in a situation where someone you love is either abusing you or may abuse you at any moment. And I would say find a relative and go there. I wish I had. Don't keep it a secret.
Did you have supportive family members at the time, or was it just absolutely a secret that you never brought up?
Never brought up, except I remember asking my mother once, and she said something like, oh, never mind. My mother was aware of it, although she, you know, pretended like she wasn't.
How did you get through that period in your life? How did you manage just to weather it out?
Well, I'm not really sure, except perhaps mental illness saved me. When I was in the fifth grade, I had a complete breakdown and became delusional. And I think I was probably a little bit crazy before that, because I don't remember sitting in school and being aware of the abuse. It's like, I don't know, I went through my schooling life without thinking about it. And then when I had my delusion, I mean, I went into complete amnesia and didn't remember about it for years. And I think that really helped me. My mind just covered it over. It didn't really come back to me until I was in my 40s and I met somebody who started talking about it. And wow, whoosh, it all came back.
Wow. Well, the brain has some pretty amazing ways of protecting itself. So it sounds like you just disassociated from it completely, which I imagine would be a very good coping skill at that point, especially if you can't escape.
Thank you. Yes, I'm proud of myself for that.
And as far as once it started coming back to you, how did you deal with all of that trauma and how did you get through all
of
that?
Well, I ignored it completely. I didn't process it at all until after I retired. I became very ill and had to retire from work in 2005. And that's when I went to a therapist and told the therapist. And that was the first time I had attempted to work on it. And I wasn't very successful with that therapist. And I've been through a lot of therapists. I finally have one that helps me.
They are hard to find.
Yes, I have a recommendation for survivors, and that is ask other survivors who their therapist is, if they have a good one.
What can children who are suffering from abuse like this right now do to protect themselves or even their siblings?
Wow, that's rough. When I think back to myself, I don't think I could have. The only thing I can think of to say is tell somebody, talk about it, get help. Hopefully there's someone, there's a grandma or an aunt or somebody or a neighbor that's really good to you, that you could tell, or even another child, even if you tell another child, maybe they can help you and tell their mom or something, and then their mom can help you.
Right, and get in touch with Child Protective Services for you.
Yes.
So just basically not keeping it a secret, it's essential.
Yes.
What would you say the signs would be in a child who would be experiencing something like this? What can people look for?
Oh, gee, there's a long list of signs. First one that popped to my mind was bedwetting, but also if kids like suddenly change and they quit talking and quit laughing and there's just obviously something different about them, that's a symbol. And then there are things like there are physical signs of it. There's a long list of signs on my fact sheet. I have a little fact sheet on my website. And okay. It has a long list of signs. TheUgliestWord.com.
The book is being made into a film as we speak. We talked a little bit about how that came about. Could you just maybe talk about the process a little bit and where you are right now and what your hopes are for it?
We did a fundraising thing earlier in the year online. and we raised some money, just a little to get started with. But then the COVID happened and we haven't really gone forward with raising money. And that's where we are right now, is in the place to get the money to make the film. I'm hoping that having the book published will make it easier for me to find a funder.
Yeah, that would be wonderful. So you released the book just recently?
Today.
Wow, congratulations.
Thank you. I'm so excited. I was up at midnight.
And where can people find it if they do want to pick it up? Because I definitely recommend it. It was a quick read. I couldn't put it down. And I'm sure you've heard that from a lot of people. It's just, it's very compelling. And your use of descriptive language to immerse the reader in the situation is just beautiful. And it's not graphic or gratuitous. It's just very visceral.
Thank you. It's on Amazon.
Okay.
And there's a link to buy it on my website also.
All right. I'll make sure to include that link in the show notes as well. And now I saw you have a change.org petition out there as far as reducing the stigma. What do you hope to do with the petition?
I just want to get a lot of people to sign it and then send it to the World Health Organization and the CDC and the Senate, okay, places where people can see, oh, well, I didn't realize childhood incest was such a problem. Let's do something about it. So it's right. Not asking for a specific action. It's just representing how many people want you to start talking about it.
Sure. So showing support for survivors and getting the conversation started.
I wanted to do a petition that said, I am a survivor of childhood incest, mm-hmm, but my publishing team talked me out of it. They said that few people would be willing to sign that.
Just because of the ongoing stigma and not wanting their name associated with it. But that's kind of the idea, is trying to break that down. Where can people find you? Are you on social media?
Oh, yes. I'm on all the social media as The Ugliest Word.
And that's Facebook and Instagram.
And Twitter.
Great. I really am appreciative that you are bringing this topic to light. There's unfortunately a lot of this sort of thing going on, and it can be happening anywhere. Like you said, it's happening in your neighborhood and people are just not talking about it. And a lot of the cases I've written about, unfortunately, most of the kids are no longer with us, but you know, a lot of them did suffer the same treatment, and it's just a tragedy all around.
It is. And it affects a person's life for life.
Sure.
It's not just the action. It's not just the childhood. It's life.
It probably changes your brain, your way of thinking.
They say it rewires us.
I don't doubt that at all. Well, is there anything else that you'd want to put out there? Anything else you want to promote?
If anybody wants to write to me and tell me that they like the book, I would love that. That would be Annie@theugliestword.com.
Again, I can't recommend Annie's book, The Ugliest Word, enough. It is beautifully and insightfully written with realistic, well-developed characters, and the story flows so perfectly that the stunning ending comes way more quickly than you want it to. According to the Center of Expertise on Child Sexual Abuse, there are 4 likely impacts of this type of abuse on children.
1. Traumatic sexualization, where sexuality, sexual feelings, and attitudes develop inappropriately. 2. A sense of betrayal because of harm caused by someone the child vitally depended on. 3. A sense of powerlessness because the child's will is constantly contravened. 4. Stigmatization, where shame or guilt are reinforced and become part of the child's self-image.
Child sexual abuse can lead to multiple problems throughout a person's life, including physical health problems, which can have immediate impacts, as well as poor health or even disability in the long term. Severe mental health problems, externalizing issues with risky behaviors such as drug or alcohol abuse, risky sexual behaviors, and even criminal offenses, and difficulty with interpersonal relationships. In some cases, a sexually abused child may grow up to commit similar offenses against their own children, continuing the cycle of abuse and trauma. From the fact sheet linked from Annie's movie website, you can look for these indications that a child might be the victim of incest:
bruising, bleeding, urinary tract infections, sexually transmitted diseases, nightmares, bedwetting, falling grades, cruelty to animals, bullying or being bullied, fire setting, self-harm of any kind, withdrawal from friends, secretiveness, age-inappropriate sexual behavior, drawing sexual pictures, chronic stomach pain, genital discomfort, alcohol or drug use, running away, anxiety, suicide attempts, depression, unexplained anger, rebellion and oppositionality, physical aggression, non-compliance.
The fact sheet is full of a lot of other information as well, so I will link to it in the show notes. It's essential to remember that, as the National Child Traumatic Stress Network notes,
non-offending parents are the single most important resource that children have after they have experienced intrafamilial abuse. As hard as it may be to report sexual abuse that has been perpetrated by a family member, this is the best thing you can do to help your entire family heal, including the person who perpetrated the abuse.
This topic needs to be talked about. Talking about it needs to be normalized. Children need to know that as difficult as it is to disclose this kind of abuse, it is not their fault, no matter what. For more resources and help, you can reach out to the Child Help National Child Abuse Hotline at 1-800-4-A-CHILD or 1-800-422-4453. You can also reach out to your local Child Protective Service Agency or call your local law enforcement agency directly. Treatment is essential for the healing of children affected by incest, so if you know of a child who is being abused, please reach out to someone for help. I'll include several links in the show notes, including a link to Buy the Ugliest Word in either Kindle or paperback format, a link to Annie's petition to end the taboo of talking about childhood incest, a link to the National Child Traumatic Stress Network's excellent handout titled Coping with the Shock of Intrafamilial Sexual Abuse, a link to the website for a 12-step self-help recovery program modeled after Alcoholics Anonymous for adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse, a link to Annie's movie website, as well as a direct link to her fact sheet that includes signs of abuse in children, and links to Annie's social media profiles, as well as her email address. In a world that has opened up immeasurably to countless difficult discussions over the past several years, the topic of childhood incest or intrafamilial child sexual abuse is truly one of the last taboos. Let's start having these conversations, even with our own children. The mindset of, it would never happen in my family, is arguably the most dangerous kind of denial. That's it for this week, guys. Join me next week for another case. If you like the show, please leave me a 5-star rating and a positive review on your favorite podcast platform. And please subscribe to Suffer the Little Children on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast listening app. Email tips, comments, questions, or case suggestions to sufferthelittlechildren.pod@gmail.com. You can also subscribe on YouTube by searching Suffer the Little Children Podcast. Visit the website at www.sufferthelittlechildrenpod.com, where you can listen to episodes and become a patron for rewards ranging from a shout-out by name on the show to exclusive gifts. Follow the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Pinterest at Suffer the Little Children Pod, and on Twitter at STLCPod. View photos related to today's case on Facebook and Instagram. Read more about today's case and many others at SufferTheLittleChildrenBlog.com. This podcast was written, hosted, edited, and produced by Lane. Intro theme music is by Dream Note Music. Other music and sound effects for the show were created using sounds from AudioJungle.net. Hug your babies a bit closer tonight. Until next week, bye guys.